Hello, this is Mike Swanson. I'm the author of the book, The War State, The Cold War Origins of the Military-Industrial Complex and the Power Elite. In a few moments, another episode of The Great Parallax Views will begin. But before it starts, let me tell you about my book. It's available at Amazon.com, The War State. It's about how the United States became a global superpower after World War II and has brought us to this situation. Grab the book at Amazon.com after the show.
I'm J.G. Michael, and this is Parallax Views. The podcast series you are about to hear befell listeners of a program known as Parallax Views, hosted and produced by J.G. Michael, who the recently arrested John McAfee once speculated was an extraterrestrial Gorgon, devised a series of episodes to be produced and published over the course of a two-week period leading up to Halloween 2020. The result of those recordings led to one of the most bizarre auditory experiences in podcasting history, the Halloween Podcast Massacre. That's right, the Halloween Podcast Massacre continues as we are joined by returning guest. It's been a while since he's been on, Robert Damon Schneck, author of The President's Vampire, Strange but True Tales of the United States of America, later reissued as The Bye Bye Man and Other Strange But True Tales, and Mrs. Wakeman vs. the Antichrist and Other Strange But True Tales from American History. Robert has been called the historian of the strange. He covers odd stories from the historical past and is perhaps best known for writing the story for what would become the 2017 horror movie, The Bye Bye Man. He joins us on this edition of the program to share with us some of his latest explorations into the strange and eerie, including the history of autoerotic asphyxiation, a mass panic involving an attack by a man in black who beat his victim with a silver ball. If you've seen the Phantasm movies, that one may interest you. A serial child attacker known as the Los Angeles Witch Woman. Some really odd connections between serial killers and, get this, Bigfoot. And stories of insane homicidal preachers. Buckle up, this is going to be one fascinatingly weird and eerie conversation with the historian of the strange, Robert Damon Schneck. We even talk a little bit about movies, including his favorite, the oddball 70s zombie movie, Children Shouldn't Play with Dead Things, directed by, believe it or not, the same man who made A Christmas Story and Porky's. All that and more on this edition of Parallax Views, the Halloween Podcast Massacre. Welcome back to Parallax Views. Robert Damon Schneck, author of such books as The President's Vampire, with Mrs. Wakeman and the Antichrist, and The Bye-Bye Man. You're the historian of the strange, as they say. Robert, welcome to the show. How are you doing today?
I'm doing very well, JG. Thank you for having me back.
So, Robert, it's been a while since I had you on the show last. We were supposed to have you on last Halloween, but the stars weren't in alignment, so to speak. For my listeners that didn't get to hear that first episode, maybe you can explain what we mean when we say the historian of the strange, because your books, they don't fall into as neat a category as one would think. They're not really paranormal, but they're not like your pure true crime books either. So maybe you could describe what you do and how you would categorize it.
No, you're right. I'm a real mutt, which is part of the reason why it's difficult to it is difficult to categorize the books. And sometimes they end up in weird places in bookstores. Somebody took Mrs. Wakeman versus the Antichrist and put it in religious writing, I guess because they saw Antichrist in the title. But the work I do started out with, I began writing about nothing but the paranormal. I love cryptozoology. I love Bigfoot. I love monsters, fiends, creatures. I love that stuff. And that was what got me started. But I also love history. And I love human eccentricity and how strange people can be. In fact, if you asked me how I would define myself, I would say a Fordian, which I guess most of your listeners know what a Fordian is, right?
Maybe you could give them a little description. I have some listeners that may be unfamiliar.
Okay. Yeah, I mean, new listeners. There was a man named Charles Hoy Fort who lived in the 19th century and the beginning of the 20th century. And he collected oddities that he would find in newspapers. He would sit in the New York Public Library day after day, going through scientific journals and newspapers and copying over articles about anything he considered outside the realm of science, things that couldn't be explained. He had a real problem with scientific certainty. He didn't have a problem with science. He had a problem with scientific certainty. So he was always looking for examples of things that would undermine their confidence. And along the way, he collected stories about monsters, UFOs. You know, they didn't call them that though at the time.
Wasn't monsters, the big one raining frogs and like incidences?
That's what everyone identifies him with: raining frogs, raining fishes, raining periwinkles. That's like the characteristic Fordian phenomenon. And today, Fordians, I can't speak for all of them, of course, but for myself, I tend to line up with the Fordian Times definition of it, which is sort of, it's not hostile to science the way Fort was, probably because science has gotten a lot less confident in the last 50 years. I mean, ever since people decided that it was very difficult to even explain reality, you know, that even what seems to exist doesn't quite exist in the way we thought it did. So science has gotten a lot more open to weirdness. And so you'll find a less hostility towards science in Fordianism. But it covers all the oddities, ghosts, monsters, haunted houses, curses, human eccentricity, you name it, secret societies, psychical phenomena, all those things. It's a little different than standard interest in the paranormal, though, and it's got a little more of a philosophy behind it. Instead of just stacking up collections of oddities. It goes with the Fortean, I don't even know if you can call it a philosophy that Fort described. Robert Anton Wilson, who considered himself a Fortean too, he described it this way. He said, Fortianism is nothing is entirely true, nothing is entirely false, and if something is entirely true or entirely false, it won't stay that way long. So it's a very slippery view of reality, that reality is always changing and that nothing is definite. It's some people describe it as super skepticism.
Yeah, you know, I was going to say, I feel like folks like yourself or some other people I've talked to, like Greg Bishop at Radio Mysterioso, mm-hmm. are more influenced by this idea of, I don't know if you would call it folklorism, but a sort of sense that, okay, I don't know if these stories are true in the sense that we usually think of the word true, or if they're, you know, hoaxes and fabricated, but either way, it's kind of interesting. They're interesting stories, and maybe they can tell us something in a creative way or a metaphorical way about the world in which we live, whether or not, you know, the actual paranormal phenomenon is paranormal or not.
Well, I absolutely agree with you. I mean, at the end of the day, if you held a gun to my head and you said, what is it you actually do? I would say that it comes closer to modern folklore than anything else, because not only can I not prove that these things happened, I don't care to prove whether they happened or not. I have known enough people who spent their whole lives trying to figure out whether the paranormal actually happens and who have gone crazy in the process to not worry about it anymore. I love the history of it, and I love what it reveals about our history and our culture. Now, I concentrate on the United States of America because it's just so much easier to do research in the country that you live in. And, you know, there's no language barriers. But obviously this kind of thinking applies everywhere. It, you know, again, it doesn't matter whether you can prove it happened or not. You can't. But you can look at it and say, okay, this experience changed this person's life in such and such a way. This experience reveals such and such a thing about the period. It tells us how they responded to this, how they responded to that. And, you know, obviously, when you when there's a convention and you get a bunch of Fortians in the hospitality suite at 2 a.m. drinking a lot, we get into a lot of discussions about whether this stuff is actually real in the normal sense of the term and things like that. But when it comes down to my research and my writing, that is not I'm not going to worry too much about that.
So you're also interested, as you said, in the eccentricities of human behavior, which leads me to the fact that your latest work, you just gave a lecture actually on the subject of autoerotic asphyxiation. We're starting out with a heavy hitter topic here. What exactly got you into the topic of autoerotic asphyxiation?
All right, I can tell you exactly what happened. 4 years ago, let me just set up a little bit. As part of, I have a Facebook page, Historian of the Strange, and one of the things I do on Historian of the Strange is I try to post an old newspaper clipping, an old article, something that's unusual about American history. Well, part of the way I find material for it, and I actually use the work on Historian of the Strange, use the research I do to always find material for that, to also find material for my writing and my research. And one of the things I found was an article from, 1930s, I think it was. And it was the story about a man who was found in the woods wearing a dress who had hanged himself. Well, when I read that, I thought to myself, oh, he died of autoerotic asphyxiation. He must have been out there doing some autoerotic asphyxia and something went wrong and he died. Well, then I realized, you know, I'm reading the article and all they can think is suicide or murder. It had to be one or the other. And they decided it must have been suicide. But it got me thinking that they never heard of autoerotic asphyxiation. It wasn't known at the time. And that got me thinking a little broader about it. And I thought to myself, how many cases of autoerotic asphyxiation were reported and simply nobody knew what it was? So I began to collect newspaper articles, and I currently have 5 binders worth of old stories from newspapers about people, almost entirely men found in situations that certainly suggest autoerotic asphyxiation. Something went wrong during autoerotic asphyxiation.
For folks that may be unfamiliar with the term autoerotic asphyxiation.
Okay. All right. Yeah. Without getting too graphic, what it is you induce a state of hypoxia. That is to say, you cut off the blood to the brain, not entirely, because that results in asphyxiation and kills the person, but it produces a state where there is less oxygen in the brain. And when there is less oxygen in the brain, people can experience dizziness, disorientation. But what they're really looking for in that is a kind of euphoria. And while they're in this euphoric state, they will masturbate to experience what they consider an enhanced orgasm. Although they don't all masturbate. Sometimes it's the euphoria alone is enough to satisfy the people that practice it. Now, the way that you cut oxygen off to the brain is the simplest way is to squeeze the neck using a ligature. And there are other ways of doing it. People put bags over their heads. They gag themselves. They use volatile chemicals like huffing. That can induce something that induces a similar state where people will use chemicals like in the lecture I talked about a doctor who had apparently been doing that with ethyl chloride, which is a topical anesthetic, and he had apparently been getting high on it as part of autoerotic asphyxia, and it accidentally killed him. He might have had a blanket over his head, and he was using that to concentrate the fumes, and that's what killed him. See, the problem, what makes autoerotic asphyxia so dangerous, is that when people start to lose consciousness, they have to stop it. They have to prevent themselves from losing consciousness, because if they lose consciousness, they will asphyxiate. So they come up with all kinds of fail-safes. And sometimes when those fail-safes don't work, they die, and that's when they get found. Well, what's so interesting to me, and this is I wasn't able to really get into all of this in the lecture. Obviously, you only have 45 minutes or so with a lecture, but they would find people in these incredibly complicated fetish outfits. They'd be chained, wearing women's clothes, wearing makeup and wigs and shoes. They would have a plastic wrap around themselves. They would mummify themselves. They would do these amazing things to themselves and die. And the people that were left to explain what happened would come up with things like, well, it must have been a prank that went wrong. I said, okay, that's quite a prank. And again, I actually called the lecture Otherwise Inexplicable, because without the explanation of autoerotic asphyxia, the deaths were inexplicable. One of the things that I found so interesting about this actually also was cross-dressing is very common in autoerotic asphyxia. A lot of men will put on women's clothing, shoes, underwear, all that sort of thing. And at the time when men cross-dressed, that was very closely associated with homosexuality. In fact, at the time, the cross-dresser might be considered representative of the homosexual at the time. And we're talking about the late 19th, early 20th centuries.
Right.
So when somebody was found dressed in women's clothing, the family had a lot of explaining to do, and they really wanted to come up with some explanation that did not involve their relative voluntarily dressing in women's clothing. So they would and also when, you know, they would talk to the police, and the police could find no evidence of them having a secret life or anything like that. And they couldn't explain it either. So sometimes they would settle for the idea that they must have been attacked by some kind of a sex maniac that forced them to put on this clothing. Or another one, another popular explanation was that they were involved in the theater or interested in the theater somehow, and they put on a costume to practice a scene. That explanation was used a lot. Well, not a lot, surprisingly often. That they had read something in a book that they were imitating. One person even claimed that they put on the clothes and killed themselves to set up a baffling mystery for the police. And I thought to myself, now that's dedication. If you're going to kill yourself to try to baffle the police, you really are committed.
How many clippings did you find of these sort of cases where, you know, I mean, autoerotic asphyxiation, I don't think it became a very well-known thing until what, the 1980s, and then, you know, people like David Carradine. I mean, right. At first, when I first heard...
David Carradine was just 11 years ago.
Well, right, yeah, I was going to say, when Carradine first passed away in the first few hours, the news reports were saying, oh, he hung himself. It was suicide.
That's right.
And then it came out, you know, thereafter, oh, this was a case of autoerotic asphyxiation. So even in 2011, you know, people mm-hmm. weren't as familiar with it.
Yeah, that's actually one of the things that I find so interesting about this, because it's become such a well-known, well, I don't want to say, it's certainly well enough known now that I've seen it used as a plot point on Family Guy, on South Park, on other TV shows. So it is reasonably well known. And but people forget that it did not enter public awareness, I mean, general public awareness, until about 2011. People started to become really aware of it around 1980, not the public, but law enforcement. Dr. Park Dietz and Roy Hazelwood, who are best known for helping the FBI develop profiling, mainly for serial killing, they, along with other experts, were collecting information and doing research on these very strange death scenes. And they collected so much material that they realized, you know, they actually put out a book called Autoerotic Fatalities, which I believe is the first book ever written on the subject, and that came out in 1980. A year after that, Hustler magazine wrote an article, I think it was called Death by Orgasm, and that probably introduced the concept to a wider area of the public, especially when a 14-year-old boy hanged himself and the magazine got sued by the parents saying that the article had inspired him to hang himself. But even then, it never really penetrated it didn't become part of popular knowledge. It's probably started earlier in England, because they had a politician named Stephen Milligan who died during autoerotic asphyxiation in 1994. And they found him at his London home hanging from an electrical cord, wearing nothing but women's stockings and suspenders, I guess a suspender belt. And he had a plastic bag over his head and a slice of mandarin orange in his mouth. I No one's quite sure why. Someone suggested to me that someone might have told Milligan that if he starts to lose consciousness, to bite into the fruit and it'll kind of wake him up. But if that was the idea, it didn't work. So it became better known in England, I think, originally. And then Michael Hutchence, the lead singer for In Excess, he died in 1997. Now, officially, his death is suicide. But what he did was he tied his belt to one of those, what are they called? They're like a hinge on top of a door that closes a door slowly. You've seen them.
We know what you're talking about.
Yeah, it makes the door shut. It keeps the door shut. I can't think of the name right now. But he was staying at a hotel in Sydney, Australia. He was Australian. He was staying at the hotel in Sydney, Australia. He had just had a miserable night. He was taking drugs. He was taking alcohol. He had a lot of personal problems. And he took off his belt and he put one end around the around that hinge thingy and put the loop around his neck and he strangled himself to death. Now, officially he died of suicide, but he was naked. He left no suicide note. And I know that doesn't prove anything, but he did leave no suicide note. And one of his ex-lovers said that he liked to be strangled. So it's certainly very, very possible that he died of autoerotic asphyxiation. But it was really David Carradine in 2011. I don't remember offhand. But anyway, it was 11 years ago. So you do the math. I'm a writer. I don't do math. But he was
2009.
2009. Okay, thanks. he was in Thailand shooting a movie. He had just done Kill Bill, which was a big hit. And he was doing another movie in Thailand, and he was staying at a hotel in Bangkok, and the cleaning woman found him dead in the closet. And he had tied one cord to the closet rail and one cord to his genitals, and he had strangled. Now, they actually did two autopsies to make sure that it was autoerotic asphyxiation, and it was. It was. One of his ex-wives said that he liked to be strangled to the point of orgasm, which is pretty good evidence for autoerotic asphyxiation and asphyxiation. And since then, like I said, it crept out of the margins and into reasonably mainstream culture. I think most adults now have at least heard of it. You know, it's not on the tip of their tongue, but it does happen, and they recognize it now. And now if they hear that someone was found dead hanging in a dress, they'll say to themselves, oh, it probably was an accident. They probably didn't mean to die. However, in other countries, this is one of the things I find so interesting. In other countries where it is not so well known, cases of autoerotic asphyxiation are still explained as suicide, murder, or accident. In fact, there was one in India where some people even suggested that it was evil spirits had been involved, because India's most famous paranormal investigator, Gaurav Tiwari, was found strangled in his bathroom. And the official explanation is that he committed suicide. But I think that he was involved. I think that he was practicing autoerotic asphyxiation. I think his family found him. I think they cleaned up the scene. I think he was probably dead, and they cleaned up the scene so to avoid embarrassment. And they then lied to the police, which is one of the reasons why the police suspected them. I don't think they had anything to do with the man's death, but I think they probably did clean up the scene. And so there's always been a little suspicion attached to them ever since, because their stories didn't quite line up the way they should. But officially, he's a suicide. It's funny that... but again, because of his association with the paranormal, that's why some of his fans believe he was killed by evil spirits, or that evil spirits drove him to commit suicide. The idea of autoerotic asphyxiation just is not—it's not part of the popular knowledge in India, which is also funny because you'd be amazed how many forensic textbooks come from India. They do so much research there, but I don't know that it's I don't know that the average cop is familiar with it.
I'm curious as to the, I mentioned earlier, how many cases of this that may have been autoerotic asphyxiation before Parker Dietz and other experts came along to sort of push it out there into popular consciousness. How many clippings did you find that, you know, you said to yourself? Hmm?
Well, I never counted them actually, but it's dozens. It's dozens. With two of the binders are dedicated to single cases that got a lot of coverage. So, but I mean, I've found cases, for example, of a man that was found. It was a weird story. This boy was out in the woods hunting, and he shot what he thought was a dummy hanging in a tree. And it turned out to be the body of a man who was, he was an older man, which is unusual for autoerotic asphyxia, because it's usually younger men that practice it. But, well, Carradine was 72. But anyway, they found this man's body in the woods. He was naked. He was hanging. And they found a knife on the ground. And when I read that, I thought to myself, oh, it was autoerotic asphyxiation. He had the knife. He probably had the knife. He was holding it. And he was going to cut the cord. If he felt himself losing consciousness, he dropped the knife and died. I've got cases of young men found wearing their mother's dress. And it was decided that it was a prank. I've got, like I said, if I had to count the number, I would say 25, 26. But keep in mind that is only the ones that were strange enough to be reported as an oddity. How many times did it happen where a big fetish or an obvious fetish wasn't involved and it was just assumed to be a suicide? Also interesting is, how did these people teach themselves about autoerotic asphyxiation? I think that they were probably curious about hanging, because keep in mind, hanging was the main form of execution for years, not to mention lynching, which went on quite a bit. And I suspect they tried it, and some of them tried it and found they liked it.
Well, there's a whole legend, right, about hanging, and I think the mandrake root, right?
Oh, yeah. You see, there's always been a connection between strangulation and sex. It was believed for years and years that when a man is hanged, he might very well get an erection and ejaculate. And the idea, the folk legend was that if his semen dripped onto the ground, a mandrake root would grow. And of course, the mandrake root had magical powers. It was a poison. It had medicinal value. And it was in the shape of a little human being. In fact, in some folklore, the mandrake is almost like a little demonic familiar that you can take care of, and it'll do things for you. And I think there's at least one book written on mandrake legends, which is really worth looking into.
So in regards to how people would have found out about this back then, you were going in that direction before I rudely interrupted to ask about the mandrake root.
No. That actually makes perfect sense, because that was a very widespread belief. And so the idea that hanging causes an erection and ejaculation means that hanging is connected to sex, you know, at a very basic level. Now, I know for a fact there was a very famous case that took place in 1791 in London, where a Czech musician named František Kacwara hired a 21-year-old prostitute named Susanna Hill to hang him for 5 minutes and cut him down, because he felt that hanging cured his impotence. Well, she hung him for 5 minutes, and when she cut him down, he was dead. And she was initially tried. She was initially charged with murder, but then they lowered it to something like involuntary manslaughter, because there had been no intention of murder at all, no intention of manslaughter. But she was found guilty of that and immediately released, because there was just they saw there was no real. She had certainly not set out to kill this man. But there was a booklet published at the time called Modern Propensities, which was about the erotic art of strangling and how men could use strangling to wake up their libidos. And supposedly, I have no proof of this, but supposedly there was a bit of a fad for hanging as a way to combat impotence in the 19th century London. Supposedly there was a club called the Hanged Men's Club. I don't know if that's true. I do know, however, that in the United States in the 19th century and the early 20th century, knowledge about it was almost non-existent. And I mean among people, and I include people that were where death was more or less their profession, doctors, policemen, coroners, undertakers, because obvious death that is just very weird, like the man, you know, the person's tied themselves up in bizarre ways, they've got odd fetish things going on, those just are not that common. It doesn't happen that often. Today, they estimate between 500 and 1,000 deaths a year in the United States, although where they get that number, I don't know. So imagine 1850. How many people had ever heard of it? And if the body and if somebody was found dead that way, how many people would recognize it as something bizarre, unless there was something really strange going on, like, you know, they were wearing their wife's clothing? Then obviously something odd was going on. But even today, an expert, somebody, paramedics, police, they can go their whole careers without seeing a case of autoerotic asphyxiation.
Can I give you an example of that?
Yeah, sure.
You know, it was funny when David Carradine died, there was this sort of, well, I would call him a professional ambulance chaser. He was a former FBI guy that turned into a private investigator by the name of Ted Gunderson. And Ted Gunderson was one of these people that helped spark the Satanic Panic. He was involved in the McMartin preschool case and all these other cases. And he would basically argue that Satanists are everywhere. You know, they're after our children in the suburbs. But it's funny because he inserted himself into the David Carradine case.
Did he think Carradine had been murdered?
Yeah, he thought it was Thai ladyboy hookers that killed Carradine.
I came across that, actually. I came across a reference to the Thai ladyboy hookers. It's a minuscule bit of evidence for that. It's not even evidence. It's one of Carradine's ex-wives said that he did not do this by himself. She said he liked to play with someone else. So she thought that he probably had someone else in the room with him. But again, as far as I know, there's absolutely no evidence for that. That's just in her experience, that's what he enjoyed. So she assumed that's and, you know, just it being Thailand, that's I guess that's just the assumption people make. I don't know. And of course, some of those Thai ladyboy hookers, I hate using that expression, but they do have a bad reputation for drugging Westerners, using scopolamine and robbing them and things like that.
Yeah, I don't know if ladyboy hookers is the proper politically correct term. That's what Gunderson referred to them as. And I just thought it was funny. I don't think he could bring himself to believe that Carradine would die, you know, by autoerotic asphyxiation. He probably also thought he could scam someone out of a little bit of money by, you know, making up this crazy story.
It's certainly not impossible. And you see, that's one of the things that also makes it difficult to come to a decision of autoerotic asphyxiation because you know somebody and you simply can't believe they would do something like that. Especially if, for example, there's a story, I don't know if it's true, but supposedly Carradine was wearing a wig and wearing fishnet stockings. I don't know if that's true. If it is true, it wouldn't be that strange when it comes to autoerotic asphyxiation. Cross-dressing, you see, again, the thing about the cross-dressing is people see it as a sign of homosexuality. They still do. But the vast majority of men that practice autoerotic asphyxiation are heterosexual, and they find putting on and taking off women's clothing exciting. But it's exciting to them about the women. How exactly that works, I don't know. I don't have that particular fetish, so I don't get the A equals B equals C, how that works exactly. But that doesn't matter. It works for them. Again, it's not strange if a heterosexual man puts on women's clothing in that context. It's part of what he finds arousing.
So, unless you have anything to add in closing about the autoerotic asphyxiation bit, I don't know. We probably scared at least a few folks away, but I don't know. It is kind of interesting, isn't it?
Oh, it really is. You know, it's funny. I closed the lecture about I gave a lecture about it to the Edinburgh Fortean Society in Scotland. And I closed the lecture by saying that a cloudburst of frogs really can't compare to some of the things that people get up to.
It is strange behavior, though. I mean, or not.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't want to, like, belittle anyone for their kinks. But no, it is sort of in the realm of things that are outside of the mainstream.
It is, yeah, and it's funny. I'm not gonna kink shame anyone either. Do what you want, just as long as you don't hurt anybody. The problem is that they often hurt themselves, and it can be quite a trauma for their friends and relatives. You know,
can I add something to that real quick?
Yeah, of course.
Another thing with Carradine, even some of his friends couldn't believe it. I mean, Damien Chapa, who was one of his actor friends, he went on Letterman and said, oh, it obviously wasn't autoerotic asphyxiation. It was because David was investigating secret societies. There had to have been foul play. It's hard for people to believe.
Yeah. When David wasn't drinking, taking drugs, and playing the flute, he was investigating secret societies. You know what I really think part of that is they don't want the death to be meaningless. So they don't want him to have died over something as stupid and embarrassing as hanging himself in a hotel closet. And I mean, and then having his photograph taken on the morgue table. It was just, that's a thing they have a real problem with in Thailand. You can get a photograph of almost anybody on the morgue table when they're being dissected. And so there's a photograph online of a Carradine lying there with the cord around his genitals and all that. It's possibly wearing women's clothes. It's difficult to tell. But, you know, it's their friend. And they find it difficult to believe that they could not know something so unusual about their friend. But his wives knew about it.
That's true. So, in regards to some other strange stories that you've been covering...
What, you don't want to talk about this some more?
there's a million different stories we could cover.
I do want to mention one, though. I just because I find this really interesting. This happened, I think, around a couple of years back. I honestly don't remember the year. Maybe 2012. But it was a case of... It was just straight out textbook autoerotic asphyxiation, but it involved a very young boy. He was just 13, and they found him in this abandoned farm. They found him in a in a farmhouse in China that belonged to his family, but they no longer live there. And he was hanged, and he was wearing, I think, his sister's swimsuit. He had put fabric under it so to give it the appearance of breasts, and he had a red dress on. And it was, he had these very elaborate knots on his, as part of his binding. And in China, this became the mystery of the boy in the red dress. And people on the internet came up with these fascinating explanations where they believed it was, that it was a human sacrifice, that it was Taoist sorcery, things I'd never heard of. Really interesting. But the official explanation was that the boy had died while engaged in a superstitious game. And the but again, I look at this and I just say, well, that's just, you know, again, that's textbook. And keep in mind, I am anything but an expert. All I've done is I've read a lot about it, and I've read a lot of journal articles about it.
Well, a superstitious game, though? Like, a superstitious game of what? Was there any further explanation?
You know, it's most of the reports are in Chinese, so I had to go on what was by what was in English, and that's all they said, just superstitious game. I wish I could give you a better explanation, but that's all I could find.
Well,
but if you're curious, look up The Boy in the Red Dress. It sounds like a movie, doesn't it?
Yes, it does.
And it's got a good name. It's not the sort of thing you forget real quick. It's funny though. I don't want to go back to this, but it's funny that the death of Gaurav Tiwari did not get some more attention in the West. I realize that a lot of stuff that happens in India doesn't make it into the Western news. I mean, you look at newspapers from the Middle East, India, Asia, it's full of Bollywood gossip, what's happening in India. And Gaurav Tiwari was very well known in India. He'd done TV shows. He had appeared in a movie. So, you know, he was well enough known. And but as far as I know, his death never got barely a whisper in the West. And it's just so interesting because, again, I really do think it was a case of autoerotic asphyxiation covered up by his family. It should have gotten some play. Just among people, especially among people like Fortians who look out for that stuff. But, you know, maybe when I write a little bit more about it, it'll get some more attention. And well, talking about it here, too.
Well, it's interesting. You mentioned that case in the farmhouse. Mm-hmm. This actually leads me to something you mentioned in an email, and it just immediately caught my eye. You've been looking at I believe 1935 case in upstate New York.
Yeah, 1935. Is that what I said?
That is what you said in the email, and it involves...
My memory is better than I thought. I'm sorry, go on.
Well, so it involves an old man and his farm that he shares mm-hmm. with a family of boarders and a single mm-hmm. man, and you just said that he was reportedly attacked by a man in black with a metallic silver ball. And the reason that caught my eye is I stopped and I said, my God, it's the tall man from the Phantasm movies. I don't know if you've ever seen Phantasm, but there's
Angus Scrimm,
the tall man with the metallic ball that drills a hole in people's heads.
Actually, if I remember correctly, there's one drill, there's one that has prongs, one that has lasers, and because they have the brains of the people he collects inside them. I think that comes later in the Phantasm mythos.
Oh, I mean, the mythos, I can't even get into it. That's a whole other show in itself.
Yeah, it really is. Okay, so anyway, with this, I don't know how big the silver ball was supposed to be, but anyway, this story went pretty much a lot like you said. Here was this farm in upstate New York in a town called Victor, which is a very small town. I don't even know if it's officially a town. It might be one of those unincorporated areas. But Victor's still there. It's in Ontario County. And it started out with everyone hearing weird knocking on the walls. A lot of paranormal stories start with people hearing weird knocking on the walls. So this went on for a while, a couple of weeks. And then this man whose name was Raymond Vangrell, he was a boarder. And he claimed that when he was going outside, he was being attacked by this figure in black who hit him with a silver ball. Now, it's one of these things where you read these stories and you want to grab the reporter in 1935 by his lapels and ask him to ask a few more questions. Like, what do you mean a silver ball? How big a silver ball? Was it attached to something? Well, again, he claimed that he was being knocked unconscious by this thing, and they were finding him like that. He claimed that he started walking around with a shotgun, claiming that this man was after him. Supposedly, some other people might have seen it, but I suspect that he was getting this small group very worked up. And finally, he was bringing the sheriff into it, and he was finally attacked, supposedly through this is where I get a little confused, because you're working with old clippings, and newspaper stories are not always right, so. He was finally found unconscious with a window broken. And I think that he said that the man with the silver ball had either thrown it through the window or something and knocked him unconscious. And but somebody else said that it looked like a shotgun blast through the window. But ultimately what happened, and this is where things get weird. The police investigated it, the local sheriff investigated it, and after he had a nice long interview with Raymond Vangrell, Raymond Vangrell said, no, none of this ever happened, it was all a hoax, and he left town and never came back, as far as I know. So I don't know if the hoax explanation is right, or whether the sheriff thought this guy was up to something, and or he thought he was a troublemaker and just wanted to get rid of him, told him to get out of town. I don't know what actually happened, but I do know that this family was apparently terrified. And there are rumors that maybe Vangrell had a relationship with the wife of the boarder. It's, you know, that's the thing about these very weird stories. There's all kinds of soap opera stuff starts to bubble to the surface. People come up with, they start to guess what maybe happened. It's like I said, it's a very odd story, and I have a binder on it. I'm going to write it up sometime. They talk about attacks by the mystery missile spreading terror in Victor. And the Victor Mystery Man. Other people claim that the ball was a blackjack and that he was just getting hit by a man with a silver blackjack. And like I said, finally he was sent back to, I forget where he lived. It might have been Rochester, I think. So he went back to Rochester, and that was more or less an end to the story. But, you know, anything that involves mysterious figures in black gets your attention when you do this sort of thing, whether it's a hoax or not, because there are so many stories about mysterious figures in black, whether they are mad gassers or they're capable of supernatural leaps, or they're Angus Scrim. There's just it's obviously even the Slender Man. He also wears black, a tall figure in black.
Well, it's so fascinating because there's so many different variations on the Man in Black. It's not just a UFO thing, but, you know, there's Indrid Cold of the Mothman fame and stuff like that.
Yeah, and of course, just, you know, the Men in Black as John Keel described them. There are some women in black. There are the black-eyed children. I mean, it's one of those things that you can really go down a rabbit hole with this stuff because there's an awful lot of it, and it's fascinating. There was, you know, one that's not as well known was the Black Flash. And the Black Flash haunted Provincetown, Massachusetts, for I think a summer or two. And he was, again, a tall figure in black that made superhuman leaps. And it got a lot of attention for a little while. And there are women in black and so many of these stories.
That last case that you mentioned, the Black Flash, sounds a lot like Spring Hill Jack.
It is. It is essentially. It was a version of Spring Hill Jack. And it's funny about Spring Hill Jack because we think of him, when we think of him at all, we think of him as a figure in a skin tight clothing, but he wasn't wearing black, if I remember correctly. He was wearing white underneath black, so that when he spread out his cloak or something, he was wearing white underneath it. And in another version of it, he was wearing furs. And okay, this is a personal thing. I don't mean personal in that it's like something I shouldn't share in public, but this is one of those stupid little ideas that has been buzzing around in my mind for years. I have no reason to elaborate on it. I don't think it's some brilliant insight, but it's always been there. And that is whether there is a connection between these supernatural jumpers and satyrs and Pan, because goats jump. And one of the things that's associated with these supernatural jumpers is utter hysterical fear, fear that goes beyond any real reason for being so frightened. And of course, that's one of the aspects of Pan. That's one of Pan's superpowers, if you like. He creates this feeling of irrational terror in people when they're in lonely places out in the woods or in nature. That's where the word panic comes from. But it's odd because if you go through some of the cryptozoology literature and some of the ghost literature, you'll find people who talk about, you know, being in a quiet place and suddenly they have this irrational panic attack. And I've read people saying, I wish there was a word for this. And I just want to say, well, yes, there is genuine panic in the genuine sense of the term. I think we should start using it with a capital P so we know exactly what we're referring to.
You know, it's interesting because let's say that all these incidents, whether we're talking about Spring Hill Jack, the phantom jumper of the Victorian era in places like London, or whether we're talking about Black Jack, or whether we're talking about these men in black, you know, I think some people want it to be something paranormal, but even if it's just mass delusions or mass hysteria, that to me in itself is kind of Freudian and kind of interesting. If a bunch of people can get into that much of a panic over something that isn't actually happening.
It is. It certainly is. And there is another aspect to it that does not get enough attention. And that is that until fairly recently, a lot of people amused themselves by dressing up as ghosts and scaring people. It's just one of those things that people tend to forget. There was a monster with a really funny name. What was it? The Caca Cocoluco monster or something like that. It was down in Alabama, I think. And there were all these stories about this horned monster terrifying people. Well, years later, this guy admitted it was just him. He had put a bull skull on a stick and threw a sheet over himself and would just pop up by the side of the road and disappear. So, and that's a fairly recent example. But when you get into the 19th century, people used to dress up as monsters and ghosts and scare other people all the time. Sometimes they get shot doing it.
Can I ask you, have you ever heard of Wrinkles the Clown from Florida?
Is that the guy who gets paid to frighten people?
Yes, yeah. He literally gets paid to scare kids in his clown suit. And they made a documentary about it recently. But I guess there are people that still, you know, try to scare others by dressing up, and I guess in this case, some people get paid for it.
I know. I've seen Wrinkles, and he would scare the hell out of me. Can you imagine seeing that at night? It's like the old Lon Chaney thing. There's nothing funny about a clown in the moonlight.
So, some other cases that you've been covering include one that you mentioned to me that I have never heard of before, a serial child attacker in California known as the Los Angeles Witch Woman?
Yeah, the Los Angeles Witch Woman. I'll tell you, when I came across the very first clipping about it, it was a little boy talking about how he had been lured away by this woman. She seemed like a very nice woman, I guess. And she beat the hell out of him. She just worked him over. And, you know, he told the police about it, and he told his parents. And when I read that, I thought to myself, oh, classic. This is an urban legend. I'm going to look to see if I can find more cases of this urban legend. And I started looking, and I found more cases. And then I found someone arrested for it, because this woman had actually been doing it. She was, her name was Cocalis, and she had been doing this for quite a while. She would find strange children, she would lure them to lonely areas, and she would give them frightful beatings. And worse, there was some technically sexual molestation, although I don't actually think that's what was going on, but technically it was sexual. So that was part of what she was charged with. And she was actually sentenced to 1 year to life in prison because apparently luring children was considered a form of kidnapping. Now, this woman had, I think, six children of her own, and one of the victims was actually one of her own children. So, you know, there's something to think about, too. But the story of the Los Angeles Witch Woman went on for quite a long time. I think maybe some people responded the way I did. They just didn't believe it. Because women don't do that, but women do. It just doesn't happen very often. She spent probably 4 or 5 years in prison and then was released. She still has, I think some of her children are still around. I was able to track them down online. Obviously, I'm not going to bother them about it, but it is interesting. And someday I might, when I finally get around to really looking into this case. I have all the clippings. I have information from the California Department of Corrections. I have some of the legal paperwork, usually, especially the stuff that involves the sexual aspect of the case.
Now, you said that with that sexual aspect, you mm-hmm. think something else was going on? What do you mean by that? Can you reveal, or?
Yeah, I can talk about it. It's nothing that can't be spoken about on the radio. What she would do is she would force the children to suckle her, to suck on her breasts. Now, technically, that is sexual. But think about it from a symbolic point of view. From a symbolic point of view, she was symbolically adopting the children. She was making them her children before she beat the hell out of them. I personally think that's what was really happening. Yes, maybe I'm completely wrong. One of the problems with getting seriously into folklore and you tend to get caught up in the symbolism and the possible meaning of things. Maybe she just got a thrill out of it. That is certainly possible, and I could be completely wrong. But the idea of suckling a child that is not yours is pretty heavy symbolism. So, you know, again, I can't say for certain.
Why was she called the Witch Woman?
Because these children would talk about this dark woman that would, again, lure them away and hurt them. And I guess the idea of a witch, like the Hansel and Gretel witch, like a boogeyman type witch. Here's a witch that would get little kids if they didn't watch out. It's one of those stories that just went down the memory hole. There is one little website about it online. They didn't do a bad job. They just did a very incomplete job of, you know, they got the stuff from the newspapers, but there's a lot more out there. You just got to look for it. Also, this woman was interesting. I can't prove any of this, but she, her name Kokalis is Greek, and her husband was Greek. And she, if you see a picture of her, she's got dark eyes, dark hair, and you'd say, oh, she must be of Greek descent. But she actually comes from extreme West North Carolina, and I suspect that she might be a Melungeon, which if your listeners are familiar with them, the Melungeons are a mixed race group that lives in that part of the country where no one's really quite absolutely sure where they come from. But now they're believed to be a mixture of Native American, freed slave, white, and they're very culturally distinctive group. And it's just possible because she certainly looks like a Melungeon. And it just adds one more interesting aspect to the story.
Now, I think a pattern is developing here. Some of the stories you're working on now, whether it's this Los Angeles witch woman or autoerotic asphyxiation, you're going into the more ghoulish and macabre territory beyond the paranormal. And another story like that you told me about was of a Detroit serial killer who I've never heard of before that was apparently nicknamed Bigfoot. What's that all about?
Oh, yeah, it's a pretty unpleasant story, but it's because the crimes were really unpleasant. But this happened in Detroit during the 1970s. It was this man was attacking prostitutes who worked this section of Detroit. The name of the road escapes me right now. It's very well known in Detroit. I just can't think of the name right now. But the police called him the Strangler. But the women who had to work this area, they called him Bigfoot because he was about 6'6", had enormous feet. And was he drove a Cadillac, and he was apparently very distinctive looking, and he would beat them mercilessly, rape them, strangle them. So it was nasty. These were nasty murders. But the story of Bigfoot went on for probably a couple of months, and there were. I hate to have to qualify everything, but your listeners have to understand that it's very difficult to get a straight answer on a lot of these things. I honestly have no idea how many victims he was supposed to have killed. At least 3, possibly 5 of these women were found again, beaten, raped, and strangled. And the police finally said that they didn't think that Bigfoot existed. They think that it was a series of unrelated murders that just seemed similar. And this man was arrested who certainly he certainly looked like the Bigfoot of the description, and he was arrested for rape. So possibly these murders were occurring, and this very distinctive man who fit the description was they conflated the murders and this man who was raping these prostitutes, and they created this character Bigfoot. That's one possibility. Certainly, I want to go into this a little bit more because the very first article about the paranormal that I ever had published, in fact. It was the first article about the paranormal, not the first article I had published. This was back in 1995, I think, and it was about Charles Starkweather. And I don't know if you and your listeners remember Charles Starkweather, but he and his girlfriend, whose name will come to me, he was about 18, I think she was 14. They drove around Nebraska in the 1950s shooting people. It was just a spree crime. They murdered a whole bunch of people. It was terrible.
Carol Ann Fugate.
Fugate, that's right. Carol Ann, yeah. C-A-R-I-L. Carol Ann. It was they were awful, cruel, cold-blooded, nasty murders, and Charles Starkweather was eventually electrocuted for it, and he really deserved it. But while he was waiting in prison, he kept this notebook where he wrote a story of his life, and mainly he complained. Everyone was mean to him. Everyone picked on him. He was a victim all the time. And that's why he eventually just decided to get back at everyone by shooting strangers. And but one of the things he mentions in this book was that when he was a youngster in Lincoln, Nebraska, he would occasionally see the figure of death outside of his room. And what did death look like? Well, death had no arms. It was a big figure with a pointed head, and it would scream. It would let out these horrific screams. And he said it was female. Now, I can't prove anything, of course, but he left this drawing, a very rough drawing of just this big shape with a pointed head. And I'm sorry, but the combination of pointed heads and screams sounds to me like he might have seen Bigfoot wandering around in his yard. So it's just possible that when Charles Starkweather was a young man, he was seeing Bigfoot in his yard. And there are some reports of Bigfoot in Nebraska, not a lot, but there are some. And naturally, being somebody who grows up to be a spree killer, he interpreted this strange figure as death. There's one more connection between Bigfoot and serial killers that I can't make up my mind whether I want to pursue or not, because it involves having to write to a serial killer, and I don't know if I want to go that route, but I almost have to, because if I don't do it, no one else wants to, so I might have to end up doing it. And it was a serial killer named Carrie Stainer, again, a very nasty killer, and he's known as the Yosemite Killer. I don't remember when he committed his crimes, probably the 1990s, if I remember correctly. He's in San Quentin now. But he claims to – he was apparently fascinated by Bigfoot. He's very well known because – he was initially well known because his brother Stephen was kidnapped by a pedophile and disappeared for years and finally escaped or was released or something. So the story of Stephen Stainer became very well known. It was called My Name is Stephen. I think they made it into a movie. Anyway, Carrie was his brother. And Carrie turned out to be this very nasty serial killer. And he claims that he worked in a hotel next to Yosemite. And
yeah, he was a handyman.
Right, he was the handyman at the hotel. And he spent a lot of time in Yosemite, and he claims to have seen Bigfoot twice. Now, it's easy to say, well, you know, he's probably a psychopath, just lies. It's possible. It's probable. But no one ever seems to have asked him what exactly he saw. I've read books about him. I've watched the documentaries that are available about him. And it just seems like it's worth asking, at least, what did you see? So I might have to write to him and ask him. It's easy enough to write to him. You know, you just have to go to California Department of Corrections website and get the address. But I'm wary about doing it. Do I want to cross that line? Because it's an ugly thing. It really is. I have never been one of those people who, yes, God, I know serial killing is fascinating, but when you get to the reality of it, it's ugly and nasty and unnecessary. And, you know, I don't know if I want to do it, but I know I'm going to end up doing it because I'm a compulsive researcher. So I really want to know what it is he saw.
I was going to say too, the for people that don't know, the Carrie Stainer case is just so interesting just in general, because I mean, he always sort of lived in the shadow of his brother who you mentioned. But not only that, he was like even a very strange, odd kid growing up. He used to, I mean, there's been speculation that maybe he had like a spectrum disorder. He would do things when he was younger, apparently, like, you know, saying to like, babysitters or sisters or just some type of women. I can't recall which women he would say this to, but he would pretend that he would hypnotize them. And he would say, "I am going to hypnotize you to take off your clothes." And I'm like, this kid's a little bit odd from the beginning.
I didn't know that.
You know, it's funny, too, for people that don't know, Charles Starkweather, I think if people are unfamiliar, they would immediately recognize the names of some movies that are actually based off of him, including or inspired by him, Natural Born Killers, California, Badlands, and also...
I forgot about Badlands, yeah.
Yeah, and then there's an old 1960s movie, which is actually pretty good. It's kind of trashy, called The Sadist.
Oh, yeah.
Arch Hall Jr., right?
Yes, Arch Hall Jr.
But I did not know there could be a possible Bigfoot connection. I'm a little bit skeptical about Sasquatch myself, but, you know... There's a lot of good, fun Bigfoot movies out there, including, for some reason, Bigfoot porn is a big thing, apparently.
Yes,
but
you know, it's for people that are just trying to, like, buy a couple of Bigfoot books, you have got to go through a lot of Bigfoot porn now when you're on Amazon. So much Bigfoot porn, and not just, there's, like, straight Bigfoot porn, gay Bigfoot porn, bondage Bigfoot porn. It's amazing. We live in an amazing world.
Yeah, it's funny. I'm a bit of a fan of, like, weirdo sort of cinema, and I got into Russ Meyer movies a while back,
mm-hmm.
and I found out that one of his, you know, main actresses, Russ Meyer was, of course, known, for people that are unfamiliar, for making movies with very well-endowed women.
Yeah, very healthy women.
right. We'll just say well-endowed in the upper chest area.
Yes.
And one of them was Uschi DeGarde. And she actually is in a Bigfoot movie that's a Bigfoot softcore porno. It's called The Beauties and the Beast.
Was that made back then?
Yeah, it was made, I believe, in the 1970s.
Oh,
1974.
Okay.
Oh my god.
Yeah, the 70s were great.
I think it was also known as The Beast and the Vixens. So.
Oh, that sounds about right. I mean, I've heard of The Geek, and which is I think that's the first Bigfoot porn. It's funny, I try to watch every Bigfoot movie, but I can't bring myself to watch that one.
Have you ever seen... There's a really weird Bigfoot movie. I did want to talk about movies with you for a bit.
Sure.
There's a Bigfoot movie from, I think, 1980 or 81 called Night of the Demon. And it's the only Bigfoot movie I know of where Bigfoot tears off a guy's lower parts, let's say.
I know I have seen Night of the Demon. I always mix it up, though, with Demon Warp.
Demon Warp is another good one. I think George Kennedy's in that one.
George Kennedy is in that one, yeah. And I think he uses dynamite to blow up the cave that the demons are going through or something like that. I think George Kennedy was at a low point in his life at that point. But there's also another one, Demon Wind, which is, I think, it's either that. What was the first one you mentioned? Night of the Demons?
Night of the Demon, yeah.
One of those is it's the idea that Bigfoot is a demon coming through the dimensions or something, and not a flesh and blood animal.
What's your favorite Bigfoot movie?
You know, I'll tell you, I'm kind of embarrassed to say, because it's such a bad movie, and yet I have watched it 100 times. It's called Snow Beast. Snow Beast was a made-for-TV movie. It was made in the 70s. It's essentially Jaws, except instead of a shark, it's a Bigfoot at a snow resort. And people are skiing, and every once in a while, one of them is caught and killed by this monstrous creature. And I saw it when I was a kid, and it scared the hell out of me. And I still find it very soothing to watch, because it's a very slow movie, and it's it doesn't make too much of itself. You know, it's just a piece of made for TV junk. And yet I find it very satisfying movie to watch. I'll be honest with you. I thought Exists was a terrific Bigfoot movie.
Real quick, I have to add something about Snow Beast.
Oh, sure. Yeah.
It stars Bo Svenson, who ended up playing who was that sheriff? Buford Pusser in some of the Walking Tall sequels. Yvette Mamou is in it from the Hammer horror films. And it's written, of all people, the teleplay was written by Joseph Stefano, who, believe it or not, that's the same guy that wrote the screenplay for Alfred Hitchcock's 1960 classic Psycho.
Are you serious? Really? I didn't know that. I mean, I knew Stefano wrote Psycho. I didn't know he wrote Snow Beast. Also, it's got Sylvia Sidney in it. And if anyone who likes old movies knows Sylvia Sidney. In fact, she was also in Beetlejuice. She played the lady who smoked, and the smoke came out of her throat because she had died by cutting her throat. I thought Exists, which was made by the same people that made Blair Witch. It has a scene of a guy on a bicycle being chased by a Bigfoot, and it is one of the few things I have seen in a movie that genuinely scared me. It still scares me just thinking about it. It's just this guy is on one of those all-terrain bicycles, and he's going through the woods, and this thing is after him. And, oh, just thinking about it gives me the chills. I can't say that I like the way this guy makes movies. I don't quite understand making every second word a swear word. But okay, if that's his idea of realism, I can't do anything about it. And also, I don't understand why every character has to be obnoxious. But again, that seems to be popular. But again, I thought Exists is a great Bigfoot film.
So another movie that we were talking about when we were preparing for this show is apparently one that is forgotten even by a lot of horror movie fans, called Children Shouldn't Play with Dead Things. And the funny thing about this movie, if people haven't seen it, it's directed by Bob Clark, who is known for horror movie fans because he directed Black Christmas, which is sort of like the prototype for all the slasher movies and the movies like Halloween that came later in the 70s. Black Christmas was from 1974, if I recall correctly. But he's also known...
And Canadian, I think.
Yes, that's very true. Well, I was going to get to that. He's also known for directing Porky's, the movie Porky's, and A Christmas Story.
Yeah, that was his. Yeah, he was an amazing man.
But Children Shouldn't Play with Dead Things. For listeners that aren't familiar with it, what would you say about it, and what was the impact of it on you?
Okay, it was the very first cannibal zombie movie I ever saw in my life. I don't know what they were thinking at Channel 9 in New York City back in the 1970s, but somebody broadcast it in the middle of the afternoon, and I watched it. And it is an utterly grotesque movie. It's one of those films where you're watching it and you're saying, okay, this was made on a $15 budget. The acting is certainly adequate. They do what they have to do. And nothing happens for the first hour. But when things happen, they really happen. And very briefly, it's the story of this theater group that's led by a guy named Alan, who is, my God, is he a prick? There is no other way to describe it. He is just a total prick. He does everything he can to rule this group by threatening to fire them, because they all want to act. They all want to perform, and he's the way they do it. So he's got a lot of power over them. And he has them come to this graveyard island off the coast of Florida where they're going to do a magical ritual.
And he's almost like a Manson character.
He is. He is kind of a Manson character if Manson was a total weenie. he certainly has the look. But he's such a jerk. He really is. It's amazing. You know, you think, why am I annoyed at a fictional character who was made 30 years ago. If you've ever seen Children Shouldn't Play with Dead Things, though, you'd understand why. But so they go to this island and they try to raise the dead, and they're all very surprised when towards the end it works, and they do. And it you know, it's your basic group of people stuck in a cabin surrounded by living corpses that want to kill them set up. But it's so strange, and it's got this undercurrent of necrophilia that of where they bring this corpse. They actually do dig up a corpse and they bring it back to the house, and Alan is lying in bed with it talking.
Yeah, and they
about
call the corpse Orville, right?
Yeah, well, his name is Orville because they dug it up. They knew they got his name off of the cross that marked his grave. So they brought Orville back, and Alan's talking about how they're going to be even closer than friends. So obviously some very strange stuff is going on. But one of my fantasy projects, I don't think I'll ever be able to do it though, is to write a big fat making of Children Shouldn't Play with Dead Things. I would love to do that. I know the screenwriter, Alan Ormsby, is still around. He has been trying to do a sequel for a long time. He's Alan, incidentally, in the movie, Alan Ormsby. I know that that some of the actors and actresses are still around. Val, who plays the woman in red who humiliates Alan, she was a popular acting teacher down in Florida. I don't know where all of them are, but I've done a little research and just to see if I could do it. And, it's one of those things where I think I would end up spending 5 years writing this book, and it would have – and I would sell 5 copies, but I still would love to do it.
And I was going to – I wanted to add. Yeah. I first saw that movie at – sometimes there's, indie theaters that will do, double features around Halloween time of old movies. And I forget what the second movie was. But the first one was Children Shouldn't Play with Dead Things. And I was 14, and I thought it was a very funny movie, very darkly comical. But I was always struck by the one, who's the one character that's sort of like a new agey chick? I made a joke. I'm like, that's the kind of girl I like.
Anya.
Yeah, Anya.
I've seen this movie a lot. I don't remember all their names offhand, but but she's Anya, and Anya was Alan Ormsby's wife at the time. And, the two of them make what I consider possibly the greatest scene in all zombie movies, where the zombies have broken into the house. They're driving Anya and Alan up the stairs, and Alan, what does Alan do? He pushes Anya into the zombies and for them to take her and not him. And all the zombies looking up at him like, you actually did that? And because even they couldn't believe it. And then he runs upstairs and the movie continues. But like I said, it's that I have found that movie fascinating since I was a child. And I know why other people might not, but I love it. I will always love it, and it will always be one of my favorite movies. So you have to remember, it introduced me to zombie horror. Before that, I had only seen movies like I Walked with a Zombie, which is kind of arty for a child. Children Shouldn't Play with Dead Things. That was right. That just hit me right where I needed to. That was just perfect for me.
I was gonna say the Anya character. I remember that when Alan pushed her into the zombies, and I got all angry because I don't know. While watching it, and this shows how weird I am, I developed a bit of a crush on Anya when I was 13, and I saw it. I thought they were all.
She was beautiful.
Oh yeah, yeah. Well, not only that, but her performance and the performance of everyone else in that movie. I'm pretty sure that they were stoned out of their mind because there's just a weirdness to their performance. I don't know. With the Texas Chainsaw Massacre, the whole cast of that movie and the crew were given pot brownies for lunch. That's actually true. I've been told that by people who worked on it. But I bet you that a lot of people on that set were smoking pot when they made Children Couldn't Play with Dead Things. Maybe eating pot brownies.
Well, you know, the little bit that I, again, there is a little bit online. The guy who played Orville, he's still around, and he talked about it. He's still angry at Alan Ormsby. He said that he was not very well treated on set. And do you remember that scene where they bring Orville into the house and they just push him to the ground? He falls flat on his face. You don't see it, but it's the sound. He said that, no, they actually dropped him flat on the ground. They had put like this thin little mattress there, but they did that sort of thing all the time. But they had shot that. It was like 90 degrees every day and 90% humidity. And it was a miserable shoot. And and it all comes through in the movie. Wow. Like I said, I truly love that movie. And I wish that I would love to spend some time. I'd love to dedicate some time to writing something about it, partially also because I would love to do the horror movie circuit, not just the paranormal circuit, for speaking and doing book signings and stuff, because it's just such a fun circuit. You get to meet everybody, and you know, it, to people who don't do that sort of thing, probably the best thing about being a writer and, you know, someone who does the conventions is, first of all, you get to meet the fans, which is so much fun, because as a writer, you spend 99% of your time alone. And it's like, you sometimes wonder, is anyone actually reading this? And then you meet somebody who loved your book or even hated your book, but they read it, and suddenly it all becomes real. So that is great. And then getting to meet the other people who write is just so much fun. I know that's why I don't do many of those things, because I just haven't, you know, I'm asked, but it can be kind of expensive, and I just don't, and it's a lot of traveling, and so I don't do a lot of them, but I love to do them. And I think the horror movie circuit would be just as much fun as the paranormal circuit.
I was going to say, I mean, give it a few years when the Bye Bye Man is reinterpreted as a cult classic movie, and, you know, Faye Dunaway was in it, and I actually enjoyed it. I thought it was a fun little
It is a fun movie. You know, I'll tell you, I would much rather that the Bye Bye Man be a weird, idiosyncratic little movie than be boring. It's not boring. I think people will look at that someday and say, you know, I don't know what Stacy Tidal was thinking, but this is kind of neat. So I have never had a problem with the way the Bye Bye Man turned out as a movie. The only thing I would like is I would love for somebody to do a documentary on what actually did happen. And so, you know, you can do a compare and contrast.
Well, for my listeners, they can check out our first episode that we did if they want the full story of what really happened with the Bye Bye Man. Mm-hmm. But do you have a little bit more time? There were just a few more cases I wanted to cover.
Yeah, sure. I will tell you something about the Bye Bye Man that I have not gotten around to doing, and that I have reason. Well, okay. If you remember correctly, there was Eli and John. Well, John, the real John, got in contact with me right after the movie came out, and he said that he could provide another perspective on what happened. And I just never got around to contacting him. I don't know if I did. I don't know what I would do with it. You know, it's a weird thing. It's like, do I put it in a revised edition of the book? Do I put it online? I just don't know what to do with it. So, and if I don't know what to do with it, I don't want to bother him about it, you know?
Well,
someday I'll figure something out.
I was going to say, I think we have to move on to a different topic, because if we talk about the Bye Bye Man too much, we'll think about him and then he'll come for us.
Well, you've got to remember that movie was seen around the world. There are millions of more people in line ahead of us.
Ain't that the truth?
Yes.
That may be the best evidence against,
yes,
if you're a skeptic.
That's right. That was one of the reasons why I published it. Let everyone else worry about it.
So, going from Bye Bye Man back to some really macabre stories, Lately, you told me that you've been focusing on, of all things, insane, homicidal ministers, religious men. What? How did you get on that beat?
Yeah, I get that. Actually, turned out to be a surprise. You know, in the 19th century, people loved. Well, you don't have to go all the way back to the 19th century. It's still like that today. People love it when a minister goes bad. You know, whether it's whether they catch him with a hooker or they catch him stealing money from the collection plate, they just love it. They say they don't. They say they're horrified. But on some level, it's just reassuring to know that, he's only human. And I started going through some 19th century clippings, and I found this story of a minister that went crazy and killed some people. And then I started looking into the folklore of it. And I found this church in Pennsylvania called Egg Hill Church, where the minister supposedly poisoned his entire congregation and then buried them in the graveyard. And I said, how could something like that have happened with me never having heard of it? And I kept looking, and it turned out that the whole thing is a legend. It never happened. In fact, one of the local historians is really ticked off because that's all anybody knows about Egg Hill Church, is that this story that never happened. So I started looking to see what stories about ministers did happen. And I found one minister who, in his old age, he was retired. And one day he picked up a shotgun and just went into town and started shooting people. He started shooting some of his old parishioners. Finally, his old parishioners had to shoot him dead just to end the rampage. Then there was another minister who cut his wife's throat with a razor and disappeared into the woods. And another one who...
Oh, he disappeared into the woods. Is this a Shaggy Dog story?
Oh, no, they eventually found him. He disappeared into the woods, and I don't remember whether he died of exposure or whether they eventually found him and just put him in a mental hospital. He was in very poor shape by the time they got him. He might have been suffering from senile dementia when he committed the murder. It's a strange story, and there's not a lot about it because it happened in a very rural area, and things that happen in very rural areas tend not to get the best press coverage at the time. You know, it's funny because one of those, to go back a little bit, one of those autoerotic asphyxiation stories I was telling you about happened in Brooklyn. And Brooklyn alone, I think, had 5 daily newspapers at the time. And New York City as a whole had over 12, not to mention all of the, and those were the major newspapers, not to mention all the smaller newspapers and the non-English language newspapers. So when something happened in New York City, it got coverage. But when something happened in like rural South Carolina, it got very little coverage. But one of my favorite stories involved this minister who went so completely crazy. He tried killing his wife with his teeth. He was trying to tear her throat out with his teeth when he had a heart attack and died. They weren't able to figure out what exactly happened, but his congregation published a newspaper. They responded to this allegation that they had been paying the minister so badly that he went crazy and committed murder. And they said, no, that wasn't it. He was getting a decent wage. He just lost his mind and he tried to rip out his wife's throat with his teeth, but she survived. The one that I'm probably going to end up writing about was a minister named Carmichael in Michigan. And he developed this odd friendship with one of his parishioners. He developed a relationship with this handyman who I'm not sure if he was one of his parishioners or he just lived in the town. And I don't mean they had a physical relationship or something like that, but it was some kind of a relationship. And eventually, a body was found cut up and burning in the church stove. And the minister was gone, and people started looking for him, and they figured that this handyman friend had chopped up the minister. They said the inside of the church looked like a slaughterhouse. There was blood everywhere. And again, the stove was red hot, and pieces of body were in it. Well, they eventually pulled the body pieces out, and it turned out it wasn't the minister. It was the guy who was the minister's friend. The minister had disappeared. He had gotten on a train and went west, and eventually he committed suicide in an outhouse of a boarding house. He tried cutting his throat, but it didn't work, and he eventually froze to death in this outhouse. But he had apparently believed that this man had hypnotic power over him and was controlling his mind, controlling his actions. And he had, and the only way he could reestablish, his independence of this man's hypnotic control was by killing him. So he did. And like I said, obviously it never went to court because he died in that outhouse, you know, froze to death. And it's a very, as you can imagine, it's a very strange story. He was a tall minister with a big beard and looked very respectable, at least in the pictures. But what actually happened is anyone's guess. He obviously had been losing his mind. Personally, I wonder if he might have been in the later stages of syphilis, because he, as a young man and as minister, he had apparently gone off the rails for a while. He had gotten involved with some women. So it's not impossible that he might have contracted syphilis. And by the time he was in his 50s, which is, I think, when the murder occurred, he had reached the stage of tertiary syphilis, where people can go mad. And it's possible that that happened. I know that after they did an autopsy, and I haven't been able, I haven't, this is in the stack of, this is in my to-do pile, the story of Reverend Carmichael. They said that they during the autopsy, they examined his brain, and it was filled with adhesions, which means that pieces got stuck to each other that shouldn't have been. And I don't know enough about tertiary syphilis to know if that's a symptom of it, but it's certainly possible, you know, something was seriously wrong with him. I have to go to, I have to find an expert on syphilis to ask about that. But tertiary syphilis was a real problem back then, because people assumed that the syphilis disappeared with the physical symptoms, you know, the pox and the sores and things like that. But no, it just stayed deep in the body and looked like a bunch of other diseases. And one of these was madness. That's one of the ways it manifested. So again, it's a very strange story, and I will eventually publish it. The lady who, the lady in the at the Historical Society helped me. She helped me so much. She gave me so much material. She said just one thing. She said, when I do the lecture, to please do it, you know, she wanted me to give it at her place. And since so many people are doing Zoom lectures now, I might do just that.
So I got to ask, the one story with this Reverend Carmichael involves claims of mind control. Does stuff like mesmerism and, oh, I was hypnotized and these kind of things, do they come up in multiple stories you've looked at or news clippings?
Yeah, in the 19th century, that was one of the big excuses. I robbed that bank because I was hypnotized into robbing it. I left my husband because this man exerted some kind of hypnotic power over me, and I didn't want to leave him, but by gosh, I was so hypnotized at the time. It was an excuse for leaving your job. It was an excuse for staying out too late. It was an excuse for a lot of things.
I'm assuming there were a few cases where, a guy said, oh, I was hypnotized by this woman to leave my wife. She was a succubus.
Yeah, things like that. Sure. It was one of the real popular excuses at the time. And I suspect that there was a book called Birdie, which made the character Svengali very famous. Svengali, of course, it's almost a synonym for a hypnotist. And what Svengali, the story of Birdie is that she was a perfectly ordinary girl but Svengali used his hypnotic power to turn her into this magnificent singer. And she became world famous, and you know, she had this wonderful personality, but it was all the result of this hypnotism. And the idea of that hypnotism and mesmerism had the power to completely change a person was very popular in the late 19th century, and it consequently had, you know, in the popular mind, it became an excuse for almost any really weird behavior. And then there was things called, you know, there were these other things where a man would suddenly vanish and then turn up 5 years later in another state under a different name, having a different job and a different family and claiming to have absolutely no recollection of his previous life. That used to happen a lot. And they call that a fugue state. And supposedly it's something legitimate that happens to people. But it seemed to pop up a lot in the 19th century.
And I was going to say, there's a really fun movie that was made a few years ago. It's sort of like an action thriller. Mm-hmm. Called, I think it's just called 88, with Catherine Isabel from the Ginger Snaps werewolf movies. And I think Christopher Lloyd is in it too. But it follows Catherine Isabel around, and she actually suffers from a fugue state throughout mm-hmm. the whole movie. And, you know, it sort of has like a Kill Bill revenge plot to it. But yeah, mm-hmm. fugue states I'm familiar with.
Yeah, and again, it was, you know, if you go through the DSM 4 or 5, whatever it is now, you will find fugue states where people do just this. But it seemed to be a bit of a fad in the 19th century. You know, people don't appreciate that mental illness has its fads. Remember when multiple personality disorder got so big right after the Satanic Panic?
It's really interesting because people still say multiple personality disorder. I think it's called dissociative identity disorder now, and there's a lot of people that even question how much of it should be considered part of the DSM and whatnot.
I think it's been taken out, to be honest. I'm not positive, but I think it has. You know, the story that really got it all started, not all about Eve, that was the story that made people aware of it, but the story of Sybil has been pretty thoroughly debunked.
I think they made a movie out of it with, was it like Sissy Spacek or someone?
No, it was Sally Field.
Yes.
And that was the movie that introduced everyone to multiple personality disorder. And the book Sybil became enormously popular. And Dr. Flora Rita Schreiber, the author of it, became the go-to person for multiple personality disorder. And multiple personality disorder was used as an excuse by one of the Hillside Stranglers. It was used as an excuse by a couple of other people who they tried to get out of their crimes by using it. But over time, people, you know, Flora Rita Schreiber eventually died, and somebody got curious about the story, and they began looking into it. And frankly, Flora Rita Schreiber's story does not hold up. The story of Sybil does not hold up. It seems to be what they call an iatrogenic phenomenon. That is to say, it's a result of the therapy, not a result of something that the person had. You know, so in a way, multiple personality disorder is real, but it's something that the patient learns from the therapist.
Yeah, it's really fascinating, especially when you get into the Satanic Panic end of that whole thing, you know, because it starts with Sybil, and then you get into the 80s, and you have, you know, daytime talk shows talking about a book like, say, Michelle Remembers, which
yeah,
I get a kick out of Michelle Remembers.
That tied the two together, that joined them at the hip, multiple personality and Michelle Remembers. That joined the satanic person, you know, that joined them. But you go on about it. You probably remember the book better than I do.
Well, it's just such a strange book because, I mean, this starts out the whole, like, oh, Satanists are in the suburbs, and they're trying to, like, get our children and commit satanic sacrifices. And there's parts in that book where she claims that under hypnosis, she remembers now that she was levitating during satanic rituals. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, I'm pretty sure none of this happened. It's just so out there in my view.
Yeah, well, I mean, essentially what she did was she asked us to believe that human sacrifice was regularly going on in Victoria, in Victoria, Canada, that constant human sacrifice was going on. You know, it really, once you start to get into the whole satanic panic period, I'm not going to be so holier than thou to say that I saw through it right away. I did not. When it was going on and people were going to jail over it, I thought to myself, there has to be something going on. People don't go to jail for no reason. Well, it turned out, no, they do go to jail for no reason. They go to jail for hysteria. They go to jail because people are frightened. And it's not an area that I know very well, but as far as I know, they've never found anything to back it up.
I want to add something to that I find really interesting. A lot of these satanic panic people will talk about things like MK Ultra. You mm-hmm. know, there's even one psychiatrist that claims to help victims of MK Ultra, and he's read about MK Ultra. And it's interesting because some of his patients have since come out and said, you know, he sort of got me to believe these things, and our relationship was one where he was taking advantage of me. Mm-hmm. And it's interesting because to me, the story there would be that, oh, these therapists that claim to be, you know, against what they were doing with the MKUltra experiments are actually using one of the techniques from MKUltra, which is psychic driving.
Oh, that's interesting. I never
thought of that. they convince their own clients, the people they're treating, their patients, I should say, mm-hmm. Their patients, that they're being, you know, satanically, ritually abused. And a lot of these therapists are fundamentalist Christians that believe the devil's under everyone's bed. And it seems like there's an element of that in this that we often don't even consider. But that's an interesting angle in my view.
Yeah, it is. I visited Salem, oh gosh, maybe 5 years ago. And they have a wall there inside the Witch Museum, the big Witch Museum, the one in the old church, where they have a list of panics and things where, you know, mass hysteria. And I noticed that they left out the satanic panic, which I thought was kind of interesting that in Salem they should leave that one out. Because you'd think that in Salem, of all places, it would resonate the most. But I guess they figure if they put that there, people will say, oh, well, you see, obviously, they don't want you to know what they're really up to.
And it's fascinating because I think we're seeing another one now.
Really?
With this Pizzagate stuff and, you know,
well,
some of the conspiracy theories that we're seeing today.
Well, you know, now what we're getting is we're getting something we didn't have then, which is internet-driven conspiracies. And the fact that a conspiracy can come and go in 2 days, that just didn't happen back then. You know, now it is literally possible for somebody to post this massive conspiracy theory and have it totally debunked before nightfall, because 1,000 people around the world will pick it apart and say, this is just impossible. You've got your facts wrong, this, that. It's amazing how quickly it comes and goes. Of course, you know, for the conspiracy minded, none of that matters. You know, they'll just say, well, those people are part of it, and there's no arguing with them. But I personally have never really gotten all that caught up in the conspiracy stuff, except where it touched on, for example, I think the satanic panic had a lot to do with the killer clown panic of the 1980s and things like that. I wrote a chapter about that in Mrs. Wakeman versus the Antichrist.
Yeah, the Ku Klux Klowns. We talked about that on the last episode as well.
Right. Yeah, that's a big thing though, and you know, not really ready to get into it right now. But it's but I really do think that was played a major part in it. It was in retrospect, like I said, it bothers me that I accepted it because people were going to jail. You know, now I think I hope that next time I have learned something from that people can go to jail based on absolutely nothing, and that you can have a trial like the McMartin trial that went on for what, 8 months? I can't even. I know it was the longest trial in California history, and everyone was exonerated because they had nothing. All they had was evidence that was created by people questioning the children. So, you know, it's something to bear in mind, especially when you do the kinds of things we do, that we can get suckered in. You know, we can, well, I shouldn't say you, I'm talking about me, really, that, you know, we should stand back and not feel too superior. That's, you know, that actually, to go back to the autoerotic asphyxiation that we started with, it's easy to look at these deaths and want to grab, like I said before, you want to grab the lapels of the people doing the investigation and say, can't you see what's happening here? This is so obviously about sex. How can you not see that? And it's easy to do that when you already know, but it's a leap of understanding for these people because they don't know that. They don't make that connection. They have nothing in their experience or their background to make that connection. So, yeah, this makes perfect sense to them. People are found this way because they have accidents, they commit suicide, or they're murdered, not because they're enjoying themselves and something goes wrong. And it's humbling. It should be humbling, rather, because it should remind us that we're doing the same thing right now. We are seeing things and completely misjudging them because our minds haven't our understanding hasn't reached that point yet. We can get all the manifestations correct. We can get all the externals right and still completely misjudge the true nature of what we're seeing.
So I want to end on a slightly less darker note. There were actually two things I wanted to get at real quickly, if we could, if you had the time. Sure. The first is actually a bit darker. You said that you had an electrocution story based on the only piece of crime memorabilia that you ever purchased. What's that all about?
Oh, okay. Yeah, I can talk about that quick. Do you remember back when eBay stopped selling crime memorabilia? There was a big fuss about it way, way back when eBay was pretty new and people were selling things like a serial killer's nail clippings and stuff like that. And people were complaining and eBay stopped selling them. Well,
you know what's funny about this is I actually interviewed I've interviewed him a few times. This character by the name of Shane Bugby. He's a real interesting cat, but Shane Bugby is actually one of the main figures of the murderabilia or crime memorabilia
stuff. Which one of the websites is his?
I don't know which website runs, but was he
in that documentary?
I don't know if he was in the documentary Collectors, but he did things like he somehow got a grave rubbing from Ed Gein's grave, and he also published this thing, Dana Plato's Last Breath, because he was working with her near the end of his end of her life. He did some things that I consider, you know, not things that he's really happy about today. I mean, Shane's a good guy, but he was deeply involved in that whole like weird world of murderabilia.
Yeah, that's a whole other thing.
You purchased this. Yes. I guess eBay was trying to get rid of all this stuff. They didn't really want people selling kind of things Shane Bugby sold.
Right. Well, this was nothing like that. This was actually, I bought this the day before they stopped. It was a crucifix. And according to this little tag that hung on the crucifix, it said that this crucifix had been kissed by Leon Skovronsky right before he was electrocuted in Pennsylvania on a certain date. I don't remember what it was. And at the time, I had just started writing, and I thought to myself, that could be the basis for an interesting story. So I bought it. I set up an account, and I bought it right away, and I got it for a good price. And I have never gotten around to writing it, but I still have it, and it's still got the tag on it. And everything that's written on the tag holds up. The guy, his name, he always appears in the newspapers as Leo Skovern, not Skovronsky. I think that he probably, either he changed his name or the newspapers thought that Skovern looked a lot better in the headlines than Skovronsky. But they called him the Chic Killer because remember how there were flappers? The male equivalent was the Chic.
For my listeners, what are these Chics and the flappers? Because I think some people may be unfamiliar. 1920s, right?
Yeah, 1920s. The flappers were girls that were they wanted to do their own thing. They wanted to wear short skirts. They wanted to cut their hair. They wanted to have a lot of fun. They didn't want to be like their Victorian mothers. So they would dance and drink and get into trouble in ways that their parents simply could not imagine. And the Chics were the male equivalent. They slicked back their hair and they dressed in nice clothes. They called them Chics after Rudolph Valentino's The Chic in the movies, this lover character. So anyway,
yeah, for people that don't know, Rudolph Valentino was such a huge figure back then that when he died, and I've been to his grave at the Hollywood Forever Cemetery, there are still people that leave flowers there on the anniversary of his death. Women, I mean, women mourned when he passed away because the women loved him.
Yeah, I mean, I really don't think anyone alive today can compare to Rudolph Valentino. I just don't think anyone has had that kind of cultural impact in a long time. You know, part of it goes to the fact that we talk about sex so much now that we forget that it can actually be much more powerful when you don't talk about it as much. And Rudolph Valentino had this enormous sex appeal for women and men. He was just that kind of character. And, it's funny. I came across a clipping the other day about his death. You know, the guy that declared him dead was a fake doctor.
Really?
Yes, he was. He had been faking being a doctor for years. He was one of those guys that just would change a profession every couple of years and fake it. It was just one of those odd things I came across. I posted it at Historian of the Strange. But anyway, Leon Skovern or Skovronsky based his style on one of the Chics. But he lived in lived in Shamokin, I think, in Pennsylvania, which is coal country, you know, coal, iron, steel mills, things like that. And his girlfriend, he fell madly in love with this girl, kind of obsessive. And when her brothers wouldn't let him see her anymore, he shot one of the brothers dead and he was sentenced to death. And it's kind of a sad story. He was very young. I think he was 18 or 19. He was a stupid kid. But he was sentenced to death and he went to prison. And this whole thing happened with him kissing this cross. And what I thought was so interesting was that the name of the priest is correct on the tag that came with the cross. The fact that they used the name Skovronsky and not Skovern, to my mind, suggests that this thing is real. And it's written in a kind of a copper plate hand that you just don't see anymore. So I've had this thing for years and I've never gotten around to writing the story. But one of the odd things about it is that the man who did electrocuted him, whose name escapes me right now, but he was the most famous executioner in American history. He called himself an electrocutioner because he ran the electric chairs. I think he electrocuted four men that day, and Leon was one of them. He just traveled all through these different states electrocuting men. And I had this idea for doing a book just on that one day of his where I tell the story of all those crimes, and they're joined together by the fact that they all get executed by the same man on the same day.
That could be like a story for a horror anthology movie, one of those old like Tales from the Crypt or Vault of Horror.
Amicus ones.
Right.
But that's my murderabilia story. I've never, I don't know, you know, it's odd. I love true crime. I truly do. But I've never been a big one for collecting. I like to visit sites, though. I understand murder tourism completely. I have gone to sites. I have been to places where things have happened. I don't know why, but the site fascinates me. Not the object, but the site, the place.
So before we close out, and I know I've kept you a little bit long here, I want to leave on a lighter note in the sense that you've been posting a lot of clippings on the Historian of the Strange Facebook page about hat pins. What is up with hat pins? For my listeners, what are hat pins?
Okay. Around at the end of the 1910s, up until World War I, women were wearing enormous hats. I don't think hats have ever been that big before or since. That was the period when whole species were being wiped out to provide feathers for these enormous hats that women were wearing.
Were these like the big floppy hats that you can see in like old books and stuff, pictures of them?
I mean, floppy hats, broad brims, these constructions of artificial fruit and flowers and feathers. And these things, like I said, these things were enormous. And the way, if you didn't hold them on with a hat pin, they fell off. So a woman had to do her hair up in something where she could insert a pin through the hat, through her hair, and then back into the pin to hold it on. Now, what was so strange about these hat pins were, and you can still find plenty of them at antique shows. They're everywhere. You'll find them. They're really long and they're really sharp. And one end is usually decorated because it fit. You know, that way it added to the hat's attraction. It would have like a fake jewel on it or something like that. But what people weren't expecting and what they didn't realize at the time was these things doubled as weapons. And there were cases of women. I found this one case of this woman who was being escorted by this small group of women were being escorted by this young man. And this young man was attacked by a group of toughs who apparently wanted to molest these women, and the women pulled out their hat pins and fought them away. They fought them off. There was lots of stories about women defending themselves with hat pins at the time, and it became sort of a newspaper fad where they would find stories about women defending themselves with hat pins, about how women could defend themselves with hat pins. And in Europe, though, there was an attempt to outlaw them because a woman wearing one of these hat pins on a public transportation, if she lost her footing, she could stab somebody. And that used to happen a fair amount. But by the time World War II came around, they had to stop wearing those giant hats because everyone was every giant clothes, enormous skirts, all that stuff had to be cut back for the war effort. So the giant hat disappeared forever. But there was a period where the hat pin is a woman's weapon, enjoyed some real popularity.
So before we had mace, we had hat pins.
You had the hat pin. And it was, and I'll tell you, if you've ever seen a hat pin, that was a formidable weapon. And it was, you'll actually... There's an interesting website just about it where they approach it from a feminist perspective about how the hat pin gave women the power to protect themselves in a way that they really hadn't. And it sort of came along at a time when women were starting to ride bicycles, you know, get out of the house, get away from, you know, not being constantly hovered over by their family. So it sort of goes together with that, the idea that here women can defend themselves in a way that they hadn't been able to previously. It's one of those things where really it sounds like such a dopey little subject, but once you start looking into it, it's really interesting.
Any particular stories of the hatpin defense that really stand out to you?
No. Again, I have the ones that I posted. But if you go to just look up hatpins. You know, do a Google search on it, and you'll find this long page devoted to it. Really interesting stuff, and it even includes photographs showing how a woman can defend herself with a hat pin. And today, again, you go into any antique shop, you'll find dozens of hat pins. There are a lot of people who collect them.
I like that we ended on the hat pins note because it's a little bit less dark.
You know, the terrible thing is I find the dark stuff very funny, and I know I shouldn't, but I do. And it's why I can do it every day of my life. And I don't have nightmares. I don't have any of that. I just enjoy it so much.
What is it that you find funny, like in a darkly comical way about it?
It's often just the weirdness of it. I mean, you know, take something like autoerotic asphyxiation. It's not funny that these people have died. It's funny that they've died wearing a pair of miner's goggles and women's high heels. That's funny. It's just so strange. You know,
it's so it's like the absurdity or the really sort of surrealness.
It really is. It's just the surrealness of the whole thing. It's just so odd. And a lot of the stuff I do is like that, including monsters, murder, insanity. I mean, it was the fact that everyone was expecting that minister to be the one chopped up in the stove, and it wasn't him. It was the guy he was friends with. You know, things like that. It's just, I don't know why, I just find that so funny. It's just so, the world is not necessarily what you think it is. It's just always reminding us of that.
It's out of the ordinary.
It is. It is. It's, if you like, it's extraordinary. And that always amuses me. That the world does not really play by the rules you think it does. And it's always going to remind you of that.
I think that's an interesting way of looking at it because, you know, just the fact that we often think about the everyday mm-hmm. and the routine. And then, you know, there's always a curveball that gets thrown at us.
Yeah. It's funny. You know, I was talking to someone about horror movies the other day, and I was saying that I have never enjoyed fantasy horror because it's not based in the everyday. And I think that in order for horror to work, you've got to base it in ordinary life. Because if you don't, then nothing goes wrong. Nothing's upended. Nothing's challenged. I've always thought that was one of the great things about Stephen King's horror. He's a master of ordinary life. And he suddenly introduces the monster. And it has a great effect because things were so ordinary until the monster came along, you know?
Well, I think that's a great note to end on. I think this is why I love Halloween, because the monsters come along and
that's right.
That's the day we celebrate them. Yes. So I think that's a good reminder. What's that?
One day out of 365, I feel normal.
Likewise.
Yeah. Well,
every day is Halloween for me, as the one song goes.
I say the same thing.
Well, thank you again, Robert Schneck, for coming on Parallax Views. How can my listeners keep up with some of your work? Maybe tell them your Facebook page.
Sure. The best way to find me is at Historian of the Strange on Facebook. That's really the best way. I check that every day. And if you sign up, you'll get a daily weirdness in your on your Facebook page.
Well, thank you again, Robert Damon Schneck, for coming on Parallax Views.
My pleasure.
Well, that does it for this edition of the Parallax Views Halloween Podcast Massacre. I hope you enjoyed my conversation with Robert Damon Schneck. A little bit more gruesome than usual. Robert's usual work has to do with
stories of the paranormal that may not end up being paranormal in the end, but are nonetheless pretty fascinating. Although he's covering some ghoulish topics right now, autoerotic asphyxiation, serial killers, child attackers, spine-chilling stuff, but fascinating nonetheless. Why don't you let me know what you thought, though, about our conversation by dropping me a line on Twitter at ViewsParallax or by email at parallaxviewspod@protonmail.com. Producers credit shoutouts to Amelia, Mark, Martin, Brace, John, Zach, Ted, Gratz, Mickey, and Chase. New producers credit there. Thank you, Chase, for subscribing at the $10 tier. If you'd like your very own producer's credit on each and every edition of Parallax Views, well, then join those listeners at the $10 or $15 tier of my Patreon at patreon.com/parallaxviews. That's patreon.com/parallaxviews. We finally have a new episode, sans my usual co-host Casey, of Parallax Views the Week that was with guest host Adam Fitzgerald on the recent brouhaha over Alan Howell Perot and his claims regarding Joe Biden and Benghazi. Check that out. We do some major debunking on that edition of the program. You can access that at the $5 tier of my Patreon at, again, patreon.com/parallaxviews. That's patreon.com/parallaxviews. And with that being said,
Yeah.